Now, where's Mr. E.X. Martin now that I'm Norm Kent, I'm the chair of the board of directors. Thank you for all coming to this forum that we have had for you for the past few days. If you appreciate what Normal has done here at this seminar, then would you take a moment and thank the person who masterminded us coming to Aspen years ago, who's coordinated this program, and who, like that Indian said, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Back in 1970, the steps that Keith Straub took to create and found Normal are being carried and nurtured today in 2013 here in Aspen with your presence. Keith is in the back of the room. He put this program together. He's enabled you to be at Jerry Goldstein's house and Hunter Thompson's farm tonight. Would you please give a round of applause to Keith? Life is a series of comings and goings, and for everything you take with you, there's something you leave behind. And take a moment to go upstairs and spend $20. It was $15 before. I just raised the price. It's $20 for Keith's book. It's Normal to Smoke Pot, because it will give you a rich history of the marijuana reform movement.
There's several chapters that aren't true at all.
Remembering, of course, that he may have been impaired a little bit when he wrote. Speaking of impaired and not needing an introduction, you know.
I'm a backhand compliment.
All the remarkable things in that 3-page bio of Jerry Goldstein said nothing of his ability to do this with the bongo. Yeah. Thank you so much for the party of your house last night. We thank you for that.
Thank you.
And as I introduce Jerry, let me just do one shameless hit for the National Legal Committee. We have over 600 members on it. Thanks to lawyerlegion.com, we've now created a page and a profile for you to access and populate and put your image and history and track record and profile on. We encourage you to do it. There are members here today attending that are not members of the NLC. It's only $300 a year to become an NLC member. We plead with you to join us. $3,500 for a lifetime membership. I will tell you that as new chair, one of the things I'm going to be doing at our June 28th meeting is I'm going to be asking the board of directors to raise the $3,500 life membership to $5,000. So you can boo me, but take advantage of the lower rate and join before the board raises the rates. But the time we've set aside now is for you to get new information on new laws, and nobody better to do it than the old master himself, Jerry Goldstein.
Thank you, Norm, for those kind lies. Let's visit about some things that are important, I think, to me and I know to you. And we're going to do this in a little the same fashion that we have done it in the past, and we're going to talk about the Supremes. This court, as we've mentioned before, is the most conservative court in the past half century. They prefer the government over the individual and big business over the government on almost every occasion that presents itself. There's a new majority on that court, and it's been frightening, and we're going to be talking about that. We're going to re-plow some of the fertile fields that we talked about before, but there's some unlikely coalitions that have been forming of late, and I would suggest to you that the Fourth Amendment and privacy is percolating much of that new and interesting coalitions. We're going to be talking about this in terms, as we often do, of the Fourth, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment, and the application of what was the only remedial device known to mankind, that is the federal exclusionary rule. We're going to be talking about the good, the bad, and, yes, the ugly. And we got plenty ugly to talk about. But for the first time in a number of years when I come to you, we got some good shit too. And it's worth thinking about. But let's go ugly early. And let's talk, that was an explanation of how to get a date in the 60s in Aspen. We're going to talk about the Fifth Amendment, and many of you are familiar with the Schatzer case, but, you know, I found this fascinating. These are all these 5-4 decisions. The Supreme Court, in an opinion by Scalia, held that a prison inmate is not in custody for Miranda purposes.
What?
That's right. They analyze it and they say, that's his fucking home. He lives there.
Oh, my God.
By the way, these fuckers have never been in a prison. You cannot eat shit, sleep, watch TV, take a leak, or jerk off without permission and somebody watching you. It is the most coercive atmosphere imaginable. For them to suggest otherwise is, I would suggest, insane. The only place more coercive is probably Ariel Cantu's place there in Cleveland. Okay, enough of that. You knew he was going to digress sooner or later. Let's analyze this another way. If a jail cell is a prisoner's home for Fifth Amendment purposes, how come it's not his home for Fourth Amendment? No, hey, fuckers, you cannot shake down my cell. This is my castle. Don't fuck with me. It's my home. I live here. I don't think so. And by the way, in one of these 5-4 decisions, Kennedy was often the swing vote, remember? This is a Kennedy opinion. He says that if you want to remain silent, you got to fucking speak up. This poor fucker was silent for 3 hours, and nobody got the hint. Nope, you're going to have to speak up to assert your right to silence. Another interesting analogy. Remember the Citizens United case? It was all about the McCain-Feingold bill that you couldn't have a corporation. It was the motion picture, Hillary, and they said it was political. And they said, wait a minute. Corporations have First Amendment rights. They have a right to speak and contribute to political campaigns. Another instance of a 5-4 decision, Kennedy writing for the majority again. And he says, yeah, corporations have a right to free speech. Have you ever heard a corporation speak?
Okay.
Go figure it. You know, this is all about money talks. This is about big bucks. And that's the 5-4 decision. That's the 5-4 new majority that we're dealing with. Well, let me ask you something. If a corporation has a First Amendment right to speak, how come it doesn't have a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent? Look, we can be using some of these opinions that they're so irrational that we're going to have some fun with them, folks, if we just keep up the hard work. And lastly, I bring you my favorite case, my fist case. I don't know how I could have fucking lost this thing. But in fight, the 40 officers all decked out in their armor plate. They're in armed personnel carriers. They break through the front gate. They set off exploding devices all over to scare the shit out of the residents. They put grappling hooks on the front door and the burglar bars and rip the windows and doors out of the place. They've got my client. He is nude from the waist down, face down in his driveway. The officer has a shotgun over his head, and the Fifth Circuit, in a 2-1 opinion, said he was not in custody when they interrogated him in that fashion. By the way, this is a picture. The Fifth Circuit had this picture. That's my client's nude butt. You can barely see the shotgun over here when they're questioning him. And the two females on this is a bad day for Mr. Pike. That's his wife and his girlfriend when the police raided the place. Never mind the tanks, the guns, and the explosive devices. Where's a guy with no pants on going to go? His freedom of movement was restricted, if you ask me. Okay, let's talk about the Fourth Amendment. There's a trilogy. We're going to talk about trilogies, two separate trilogies. This is the trilogy of horrors. And this trilogy limits the application of the federal exclusionary rule, despite Scalia's admonitions to the contrary. All 5-4 decisions, Kennedy is on the wrong side in all five of the cases, all three of the cases, the first being Hudson. And Hudson Scalia makes this comment, which I bring to you each year because it amazes me so much. We have never held that evidence is fruit of the poisonous tree simply because it would not have come to light but for the illegal actions of the police. We have never fucking held that evidence is fruit. I mean, what have we been doing for the past 44 years, guys? I mean, I thought that was the definition. They illegally violate my constitutional rights. We suppress the evidence. That's the remedy, not according to Scalia. What Scalia says is that there are substantial costs in this fight. Sometimes by applying the exclusionary rule, sometimes the guilty go free and the dangerous remain at large. The guilty go free and the dangerous remain at large. 3 years later, the screw tightens. And Herring. Herring is the Chief Justice this time, another 5-4 decision. And Roberts cites Hudson, and he reminds us, hey, suppression is not the automatic remedial avenue. Remember, we've never held? Okay. He says, the question turns on the culpability of the police and the potential exclusion to deter wrongful police conduct. This is a balancing test, folks. It's a cost-benefit test. It has to be sufficiently deterrent, sufficiently deliberate to deter, and I thought that's what negligence law was based on, but I left that 45 years ago in law school. It has to be sufficiently deliberate to deter police conduct, and it has to be sufficiently culpable to warrant the social cost. Sufficiently intentional and sufficiently culpable to warrant the social cost. These balancing tests, I call them toilet bowl tests. You can see the pristine white bowl, and you pull the chain, and all your hopes and dreams go down the drain, like little brown things. When a judge says, I'm going to apply the totality of the circumstances to your situation, I see a big toilet bowl in the sky. And what are they balancing? What are the social costs they're balancing? Allowing the guilty to go free and the dangerous to remain at large. When are we going to win against that? When are we going to win that balancing test, if there is going to be one? 2 years later, there's a third case in the trilogy, and it's U.S. versus Davis. This is not a 5-4 decision. The issue there was, is an officer entitled to rely on good faith upon well-settled case law? If you remember, in Belton, New York versus Belton, the Supreme Court set up a bright line test. And the bright line rule was that officers obviously can't measure whether someone can reach and destroy evidence or gain a weapon for escape. So we're just kind of a bright line rule. Anytime they engage in a custodial stop, we're going to allow them to search the entire passenger compartment and any containers therein. Well, that got pretty ridiculous after a while. Some of the courts said, even the Fifth Circuit said, well, if you could search it there on the site, there's no, I don't know why you couldn't take it to a safer location like the pounding lot and search it there. And so it was not related in any kind of temporal proximity. Then came Arizona versus Gantt. And the Supreme Court, understandably, Scalia leading the pack, he understands the Fourth Amendment, even if he's not wild about the Fifth Amendment. And what the court held there was, you're going to have to look at these cases case by case. There can't be some bright line rule. We're going to apply a rational basis to the idea that the officer might fear that his safety is in danger, that evidence will be destroyed. And this is, you know, at the guy in Gantt, little Gantt is handcuffed behind his back. He's in the back seat of a patrol car. There's no door handles. There's a big screen cage. They asked, they said, do you have a single instance where somebody's hands are handcuffed behind their back, there's a screen, there's no door handles, somehow they break out of the police car and then break into their car that you've got there, and they grab a weapon or evidence, and they could come up with them. So Arizona versus Gantz did away with the New York versus Belton bright line per se rule. In Davis, when questioned about, this officer, by the way, had searched the car prior to Gantt and said he was relying on New York versus Belton's bright line rule that he could search the entire passenger compartment when he engaged in a custodial arrest. Alito says, well, when the police act with an objectively reasonable good faith belief that their conduct is lawful, exclusion cannot pay its way. Balancing test, cost-benefit analysis, toilet bowl fuckers. I'm talking pull the chain. But what happened when we look at this concept of good faith reliance? Remember, the good faith test in Leon came about to encourage warrant practice. There was a preference for warrant practice. The idea was to insert a neutral and detached magistrate, if there is such a thing, between the citizen and those often engaged in the competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. There was a reason for it. We wanted to allow them to rely in good faith on the warrant. Here we're talking about they're relying upon well-settled law. Fuck, the court can't even. All these decisions are 5-4. They're not even agreeing on what the settled law is. But if they are entitled to do that, and Davis now tells us that they are we going to be cross-examining them as to what their understanding of the settled law is in these cases? Do they have to be right? Or can they just have a good faith guesstimate of what they think the law should be? Where does good faith start and where does it end? And by the way, let's take it a step further. Remember Scalia, we've never held that exclusion is the automatic remedy just because the police violate your constitutional rights. Well, Alito disagrees with that. He says, yeah, that is what we held. And he says, look, we're changing the rules. He says, we came to acknowledge the exclusionary rule for what it undoubtedly is, a judicially created remedy for the court's own making. We abandoned the old reflexive application of the doctrine and imposed a more rigorous weighing of its cost and deterrent benefits. We also recalibrated our cost-benefit analysis in exclusion cases to focus the inquiry on the flagrancy of the misconduct at issue. So now, in order for the conduct to warrant the exclusionary remedy, we have to be able to demonstrate that the police acted deliberately, that they acted culpably, and that they acted flagrantly, whatever that is. I thought that was some kind of sexual activity. But in any event, in order to apply, these three were requisites, according to Alito. And what's interesting is it was an 8-2 decision. Only Breyer and Ginsburg dissented. I mean, where was Sotomayor? Where's the rest of that group? That's a frightening concept when you look at what they were saying. And where's this push? I do this every year, but I like to remind myself where all this comes from. Remember the Chief Justice, I'm just going to be an umpire, I'm going to call the balls and strikes? Well, when he was assistant counsel to the President of the United States in 1983, he sent this letter, which he forwarded a study, which he said should be highly useful in our campaign to amend or abolish the exclusionary rule. This is no fucking umpire, folks. This is somebody with an agenda. And by the way, if you think it's just, you know, nasty Chief Justice Roberts and Alito and their gang of the, no. The most recent appointee. The same year, 1983, she hadn't gone to law school yet, and obviously wasn't the dean of Harvard Law School yet. Do you realize, by the way, that the first fucking case she ever argued in a JP court was as Solicitor General of the United States, arguing a very important case dealing with state secrets in the Supreme Court of the United States. But that same year, she was on leave from Princeton doing her doctoral thesis at Oxford in 1983, and her thesis was the development and erosion of the American exclusionary rule, a study in judicial method. And what she says is the exclusionary rule's only consequences are to keep probative evidence from the trier of fact. She's right, by the way. Right. Only guilty people benefit from a suppression order, from the exclusionary rule. You know, if you don't have any shit, there's nothing to seize, there's nothing to suppress. So, you know, I agree, but just so you'll know, this is where we're coming from, and perhaps this is why she was in that majority in the 8-2 decision in Davis. We'll know. Now, remember I promised some good news before we all go and get fucked up at El Farm. I'll be there with you guys. Good news. This is some good news. The new majority has somewhat changed faces. These are some strange bedfellows and some unlikely coalitions, and it's fun, folks. Just take a look at the various decisions and various opinions that are coming out of the court. This new trilogy of cases, it redefines the definition of the Fourth Amendment, what constitutes a search, and when we apply the exclusionary rule. 2 months ago, since our last visit, Supreme Court decided the dog sniff case, Florida versus Hardinas. In this case, there were two detectives come over to Julio Hardinas' home, and they're standing on his front porch with Frankie the fucking dog and sniffing under their door. All right? And the issue there was whether a drug-sniffing dog on your porch sniffing at the door constituted a search. 5-4 decision, Scalia writes the opinion. He's joined by Thomas, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor in Kagan. Interesting bedfellows, folks, Thomas and Kagan. Kagan concurs and writes a very interesting opinion relying upon a totally different approach, a much more plausible and a much safer approach for all of our rights of privacy. And she's joined by Ginsburg, and you gotta love these girls, and Sotomayor. Alito dissents, and he's joined by the usual suspects. Roberts, Kennedy, Breyer, where the fuck did he slip off? This is some interesting things that are happening now. Scalia goes back to his concept of original intent. We do this every year, but how the fuck does he know? Was he there? The concept of all men are created equal, they meant that when they wrote those words. These guys were not gender perfect. Women didn't get the right to vote or sit on juries until 50 years after African Americans. We now know that our individual rights and liberties cannot be relegated to the privileged few. Times have changed, and so have we. Scalia goes back to 1765 to Intech versus, by the way, he cites this in his opinion over and over again, but not just in Hardinas and Jones as well. And he's fascinated by it. And it's a tort case. From the Court of Common Pleas, written by Lord Camden. And Lord Camden, and don't you love their language? Our law holds that the property of every man so sacred that no man can set his foot upon his neighbor's close, whatever that is, without his leave. I love it. All right. Scalia focuses on a physical intrusion. That is, the physical intruding on papers, houses, and effects is a search within the original meaning of the Fourth Amendment. The original meaning of the Fourth Amendment. He focuses on physical trespass. His idea is this castle doctrine, that, you know, that a home is the first among equals when it comes to Fourth Amendment privacy rights. And this physical trespass approach, this castle doctrine, how does it apply here with Frankie on the front porch? You know? Frankie ain't inside the castle. He's outside the house. Remember the concept that we got from those trilogy of standing cases, Rackus, Rawlings, and Salvucci, that we must eschew arcane property doctrines? Remember, we're not only going to look at these real estate doctrines. Well, in Hardinas, Scalia focuses on curtilage, and I can't think of a more arcane fucking property doctrine than curtilage. It's not in most people's vocabulary. And what it means is that area immediately surrounded and associated with the domestic operation of one's home. It is part of the home itself. And Scalia says, based upon that, that Frankie is on the porch. That's part of the curtilage. So that by taking Frankie up the steps, he has brought him into and intruded upon this person's home. Intech versus Kerrigan, the case, he talks about it, says that even a minor intrusion, a bending a blade of grass or leaving a footprint. I mean, I don't know where that leaves the open fields doctrine, but you know, and what about mailmen and salesmen that happen to come up to your front door? Are they bending a blade of grass, leaving a footprint? Are they intruding? And they use social custom to get around that. But in any event, they don't decide the issue that they said they were going to decide. They don't say that the dog sniff was a search. No, they say that fucking Frankie was a trespasser on the porch. That's a whole different concept. And that's why I like the girls' approach, because what they say is it shouldn't depend on a physical intrusion, although this was one, and we're not arguing with Justice Scalia or Thomas, who's always close up his behind, but we are suggesting a different concept, and that is that one has a reasonable expectation of privacy, that one's not going to have some agent there with a dog trolling the front door odors. 1.5, yes, sir.
Just wondering, did the dog actually matter in that case? If the dog wasn't there and it was just the two detectives, were they intruding?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And their smell would have intruded. 1.5 years ago in Jones, before Hardinas, the Supreme Court confronted a similar but different issue. And that was whether the attachment and tracking of a GPS device on Antoine Jones's pickup truck constituted a search. And again, you know, two distinct and discrete issues, attaching the GPS device and monitoring the GPS device. And Scalia gets on his high horse, citing Insect versus Carrington again, loves Lord Camden. And he says, you know, relying on a property-based approach, at bottom we must assure preservation of that degree of privacy against government that existed when the Fourth Amendment was adopted. As explained for most of our history, the Fourth Amendment was understood to embody a particular concern for government trespass upon the areas it enumerated. You know, persons, houses, property and effects. There you go. That's Scalia. Scalia goes on, and this property-based attachment of the GPS device doesn't deal with the separate and discrete issue of monitoring. And I'll tell you why that becomes important. And it's terribly important to most of us. The idea that we're only protected, as Scalia says, when they attach a GPS device is very little protection at all, because we fucking bought the GPS device. It's already attached. But almost everything we have is attached, and they've got it, and they can use it. So the attachment doesn't protect me very much. So that majority, by the way, it's a 9-zip opinion. You know, that's the only easy thing about it. You need to read these separate concurring opinions, because the danger we have is that that this information, and by the way, it's not just GPS device. It's everything we do. I don't know if you noticed, but the CIA is now leaking little by little. Have you ever thought about oral communications? We worry about texts and emails, but what about the fact that your oral communication is being sent digitally? I never thought about that. And it appears now that they have access to that. And by the way, they don't have to do it real time. They don't have to get a warrant to look for it. It's being stored. Every bit of this information goes to a fucking cloud somewhere and is stored where they can data mine it years later to decide, what was Goldstein doing out at Owl Farm that day? And they'll know where I was. And they'll know much more than what I was, because they'll be able to use all of my data, emails, texts, oral communications, and they'll be able to listen in and retrieve them. What happened to Katz's...
Does the issue?
Well, Alito makes the argument, we're going to get to that, about how we can deal with that. I'll tell you what, let me save that for 3 seconds, because it's a wonderful question, and I think we've got a real problem on our hands. But what happened to Katz's... Remember Katz? How many of y'all remember what a public telephone booth looked like? All right. Superman and Sam Katz like public telephone booths. And what the Supreme Court said when they were monitoring Sam Katz's conversations was that the Fourth Amendment protects persons, not places. What happened to that approach? Because Scalia's emphasis, focus on places is not in keeping with the expectation of privacy concept that Katz had talked about. Alito concurs, and he's joined by Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan, and he says, there's no way we can apply 18th century tort law to decide a 21st century technology issue. It is almost impossible to think of late 18th century situations that are analogous to what took place in this case. And he's right. And he talks about the fact that a search no longer requires a physical intrusion. For science has brought forth far more effective devices for the invasion of a person's privacy than the direct and obvious methods of oppression which were detested by our forebears and which inspired the Fourth Amendment. Alito goes on, and he says, look, there's lots of new devices now that provide this kind of information. Closed-circuit television. I mean, have you ever had a convenience store robbery where you don't get to watch it? You know, the Boston bombers, I mean, they were in sight of Lord and Taylor. We talked about that yesterday for a minute. London has these cameras on every street corner in downtown London. Automatic toll clutch. I mentioned this when we were doing, we're going to talk about the Martin case at the end of this. But, you know, I was, Williamson County is north of Austin. San Antonio was south of it. I would drive using the toll road and thinking, God, I don't have to go through the toll booth. And every month I'd get my bill with, they have a picture of me at the wheel with my license plate. They knew exactly where I was every time. I didn't fool anybody. They got OnStar. Help me, I'm falling. But your car, when your car is doing something funny, they know it. They not only know where it is, they know what the fuck's going on and what you're doing in it. Probably. Smartphones. I mean, all our devices that are electronic come with all of these devices already installed. The concept that Scalia was protecting us from the physical intrusion is of little solace to most of us. Alito goes on, and he talks about Title III, and he says, right after Olmstead, the Congress responded, and they passed Title III, the federal wiretap statute. And he said, that's a legislative solution. I don't think this falls within the wiretap statute, but here's the problem. Who wiretaps? Jealous spouses and the government. Nobody else is interested in listening to our boring fucking lives. It's like watching Patreon. The difference is that this information, this data mining that is on our computers is very valuable shit, and it's commercially viable, and there's a reason why they give you this shit for free if you can afford the service. There's a reason why we don't have to, I don't know, Oliville, every time you hit, I agree, when you enter one of these things, you've read the 3.5-page small print. You understand that you gave up all your rights, that it's not your property, that all that information is owned by a third-party provider. And we all have dealt with all of that. But think of the consequences. Because that information, the Obama administration didn't miss much in the last election. A friend of many of ours, Craig Capitas, is anchoring for France 24 now. And he said, Golsey, we think this could be really a tight deal between the Electoral College and the popular vote. We need somebody to come explain this to the Eurozone. We have my lovely bride of 44 years who's here, and I were in Paris, so I said, sure, I'll come down. I stayed up all night. It wasn't close, so that wasn't an issue. The only thing they asked me, is, said, well, you're from Colorado. How come marijuana won 3.5 hours before Obama did? So thanks to you guys, we showed them, didn't we? But they understood that. They were using this data money. The demographers are very keen on this, and every retailer uses this information. There's a reason why when you change your vitamins, they know you're pregnant, and then all of a sudden you get the coupons so they don't waste those coupons on a bunch of old guys. This is very valuable information, and I think we'll have a hard time getting a similar legislation passed because nobody gave a shit about wiretapping. Everyone was worried about it. Don't forget the Title III makes it a crime to engage in that conduct. Well, you've got a lot of marketing firms that are making a lot, gazillions of dollars. Watch it when all of a sudden we try and make what they use a crime. It's going to be interesting. Sotomayor concurs, by the way, and she says even short-term monitoring. By the way, in this case, they monitored it for 28 days. By the way, they did get a warrant, but they got a warrant for D.C. that was good for 2 weeks. They came in a week late, and they installed it in Maryland. So it was treated as a warrantless installation. But she says even short-term monitoring should come under the auspices of the Fourth Amendment. She says it's a comprehensive record. It knows, just like your computer knows, it's 24/7, 365. It knows everything. As she pointed, these are her words. And it knows when you went to the psychiatrist, when you went to an abortion clinic, when, God forbid, you went and saw a criminal defense lawyer. You will go to a by-the-hour motel. You go to a strip club. You go to a mosque, a synagogue, or a church. You go to a gay bar. All of these things, it knows. and it knows it forever, and it accumulates it and stores it forever, and someone can come back and mine it, a marketer, the government, the police. Scary. And Sotomayor goes on, she says, we may need to reconsider, and Alito touched on this as well, this whole expectation of privacy. Because quite frankly, in this digital age, people are willing to give this up. That they're willing to make a value judgment call. It's very convenient to be able to, look, I mean, how did you find the Gantt? Well, you fucking put in Gantt, Aspen, and you find it. That's pretty convenient. Do you want to give that up? It also provides security. There are certain security concepts that this technology provides for us. I'm not sure we want to put it up for a vote. And she talks about phone numbers, text, every time you text somebody, every time you go into a website. How do you think they got WikiLeaks? Every piece of email that you send, that's all going through a third-party provider. And everything you order on the internet, that's all taken care of. And that makes five votes for at least long-term monitoring constitutes a search. It also makes five votes that are willing at least to reconsider the definition of what constitutes a search. 6 months ago, Jones comes back to the district court. And it's an interesting opinion because what the court there held is it's on remand. They said, okay, you can't put the GPS device on Antoine Jones's truck. But lo and behold, they weren't just monitoring the truck's GPS device. They were triangulating from cell towers. And they got a warrant under the Stored Communications Act of 1986 to obtain 4 months of the cell tower information, which was able to track the truck. And the Stored Communications Act of 1986, also known as the Electronic Privacy Act, it permits the obtaining of all this stored electronic data without a warrant, without a showing of probable cause, and without any minimization, as you'd have under Title III, and without any court intervention. In Warshak, the Sixth Circuit 2 years ago held that that was, it applied in this situation, that would be an unconstitutional invasion of your Fourth Amendment right to privacy. And great language, the Fourth Amendment must keep pace with the inexorable march of technological progress or its guarantees will wither and perish. But, lo and behold, they were entitled to rely in good faith upon the statute. Otherwise, you know, what are we asking of our police? On remand and Jones, they had two answers. One, hey look, there is, under the Stored Communications Act, there is no exclusionary rule remedy like there is in Title III. So you don't suppress. And secondly, they were relying upon the statute in good faith. So we now know that an officer can rely in good faith upon a warrant under Leon, upon a statute under Jones and the Warshak case, and under Davis upon their interpretation of whatever they believe in good faith must be or should be the law. By the way, not to worry, many of our providers, Google, earlier this year, said that they're no longer going to honor subpoenas and they're going to require a warrant to get your information. Twitter followed suit. Are we going to rely upon these carpet maggots to protect our Fourth Amendment privacy rather than the courts? What about technology? What about the fact that this new sophisticated surveillance, it's different from what our founding fathers, that Scalia liked to think about, physically trotting upon bending grass and leaving their footprints. You know, our founding fathers were concerned about King George's redcoats breaking down their door and rummaging through their underwear. It was physical. You could see it, you could feel it, you could smell it, you could hear it. This data mining, this electronic surveillance, is stealth-like. You can't see it, you can't feel it, you can't smell it. And perhaps it's more dangerous, and perhaps it's more sinister because of that fact. Because it hits at the crossroads between your Fourth Amendment right to be reasonably free of unconstitutional searches and your First Amendment rights to free speech, to free association, to bitch about your government. And it has a chilling effect because they're stealing something more valuable than your underwear or your papers. They're stealing your thoughts. They're stealing your communication. And that we need to have some concerns about. Cell phones. You see, there's a case on this issue almost weekly, and that is a search incident to arrest. Can they look at the numbers on your phone? Can they look at the text and the photographs on your phone? The Fifth Circuit says sure. Florida Supreme Court, May 2nd, I think it was the Southwood case, held that they couldn't. But we're going to see, the cases are disparate. They're all over the place. And I think we're going to see a lot of this. I don't think what's on your phone is in plain view. I think it's not immediately apparent to the officer that he has evidence before him. And I know this stuff. Well, the drug dealers always keep all their shit, you know. It's the same old ritual. But there's a difference here. This isn't a notepad. This has your whole life on it. It has everything about you. It is your life. And it starts, and there's no way to, you think you can delete something on your phone? You've got another thing coming. There's a terahertz device. New York City Police has this. It's able to look at you. It was developed by Scotland Yard. And it senses radiation, and it can see the outline of a weapon on your person. Is that a search under Kylo, like the, you know, the infrared detection device? You know, how does it know what's on the other side of the wall? You know, well, it's kind of like the Hubble telescope. Remember, it gives you a sense of, you know, too young to remember it, but it was sending us pictures back from space, and they say, this is Saturn. It looked like a big booger on a black deal. And they'd say, well, we're going to computer enhance it. Now it's in every ring. It's perfect. Well, it does the same thing. It computer approximates it, and it does a pretty good job. Well, is that a search when they use this device to look at a person? Is it a virtual pat down and Terry stop? What is the standard for application of that device? Domestic drones. We're in legislation now before the Senate. They're almost invisible. They can be in the room with you, watching you. I'm not talking about dropping a bomb on you. I'm talking about surveillance. Google. How many of y'all know about Google Glasses? This is some amazing shit. They're out now, by the way. These are glasses that when you look at someone, it does a facial recognition. And then they can download all the information that, from other sources that you can have on that person.
Oh, my God.
This, by the way, we're tickling right on the verge of where it's going to get really interesting, folks. The predpol, this is some computer algorithms that somehow can decide future dangerousness. It can pick up, no, you won't have to have, like in Texas, we have the third question, is this person, you know, likely to commit dangerous acts in the future? Fuck it, just plug them up to the computer.
So it's a computer phrenology?
Yeah, that's it, you know. Yeah, I mean, maybe we can stop that with, you know, we can reverse it. Perhaps there's a recognition that as the technology increases, our privacy decreases proportionally. Perhaps there's some recognition that today with this radical technology, we need greater protection, not less. 2 months ago, Missouri versus McNeely. I know you're all familiar with it, but it's another interesting case. The issue there was whether the natural dissipation of alcohol in one's bloodstream constituted per se exigent circumstances, but eliminating the need to get a warrant. Fractured court, by the way, 8-1. All right, 8-1. But they, 8 justices agreed that there's no per se rule. All right, that's about all they agreed. There's no per se rule that simply because alcohol naturally dissipates in your blood that we don't have to worry about getting a warrant. That they agreed on. But the fractured court, you got 5 separate opinions. First, you got Sotomayor joined by Scalia, Kennedy, Ginsburg, and Kagan. They said you got to do it case by case. You can't have some rule. Then Sotomayor writes a second opinion. She's joined by Scalia, Ginsburg, and Kagan, still loving the girls. And they said, look, the Fourth Amendment won't tolerate some kind of rigorous per se rule. Then you had Kennedy concurring. And he says, okay, it's a case-by-case analysis, but we ought to look at and consider in the future applying some rules. Then you had Roberts, the Chief Justice, joined by Breyer. Where the hell is he? I mean, he dropped off the face of the Fourth Amendment. Alito concurring, and they said, you got to have rules. While we agree, we're going to look at it case by case, but there ought to be rules. For example, if it's going to take too long, if you can get a warrant in a reasonably expeditious fashion, you ought to get one. But otherwise, there's no need. Thomas dissents, and he says dissipation of alcohol in the blood is a per se exigent circumstance obviating the need for a warrant. The best news yet, and this is worth the price of admission, just to think about, and that is the Jones GPS case, the Hardinus dog sniff case, and the McNeely blood test for alcohol. In all three of those opinions, very recent opinions with the new court, there's not a word about any fucking balancing test. There's not a word about any rigorous cost-benefit analysis. And these guys weren't culpable mischievous. There's not a word about deliberate. There's not a word about culpable. There's not a word about flagrant. Not in Scalia, Alito, Sotomayor, Kagan, or the Chief Justice's opinion. None of those opinions in any of these three cases mentioned any of those, that language that was so frightening in the trilogy of horrors that we talked about with Hudson, Herring, and Davis. Sixth Amendment. 1 year ago, two opinions from the Supreme Court, and I know it's a little bit off the topic, but I'm just fascinated by the fact that both of them, by the way, 5-4, both of them are written by Kennedy, and he's joined by the usual suspects, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and you can guess who dissents. But in Missouri versus Frye, they said that if you're a lawyer, you got to tell your client what the offer was before you reject it. Duh. Bobby Scalia goes batshit over this. And by the way, he was offered 90 days. The lawyer rejects it for him out of hand, and the poor guy gets 3 fucking years. The companion case came out the same day, Lafler. In this case, they did tell the client what the offer was. But the lawyer tells him, look, you're charged with homicide. You shot them 3 times below the belt. That, as a definition, can't be homicide. I mean, I'd rather take 1, you know, to the heart than 3 to the gonads. I mean, I don't know where this lawyer was coming from, just a practical matter. By the way, this guy had a 7-year offer, and he got 30 fucking years. And the Supreme Court finds that that denied him the expectation of effective assistance, and they took it out of the trial context and put it in the plea bargaining context. Scalia goes batshit. He says this elevates bargaining, plea bargaining, from a necessary evil to a constitutional entitlement. Well, duh. I mean, 99% of the cases are resolved by plea bargaining. The client's not entitled to know. The client's not entitled to reasonably decent, effective advice in making that decision. Kennedy says, look, the fact that you're guilty doesn't mean that you don't have a Sixth Amendment right to an effective lawyer. And we all know that when you look at those sentences, where is Scalia coming from? He said, well, they got a fair trial. Yeah, right. What if a person requests counsel? That's the second level of Miranda. We talk about this, but it's worth repeating because it takes us into my last journey. Keith, I'm going to get you to Alphorn by 4 o'clock. Miranda, no, we'll be out of here on time. Miranda and his progeny. Think about this. Miranda stands for the proposition that once you are in custody, any interrogation is to any fucking crime, you're entitled to a lawyer. And at least to know you have a right to a lawyer and a right to refuse. In Minnick, the court goes a step further and says, once you invoke that right to counsel, you can't thereafter waive it without the lawyer being present. Otherwise, unless the initiated by the accused, there should be no further intercourse between the police and the individual, those engaged, the police in the. Operation of attempting to seek out those among us who are guilty. Scalia dissents. He goes batshit again. He says, while every person is entitled to stand silent, it is more virtuous for the wrongdoer to admit his guilt. I love this. I know I read it every year, but we should then rejoice in an honest confession rather than pity the poor fool who has made it. And we should regret the attempted retraction of that good act rather than seek to facilitate and encourage it. To design our laws on premises contrary to these is to abandon belief in either personal responsibility or the moral claim of just government to obedience. The moral fucking claim of just government to obedience. This guy either went to a Jewish or a Catholic prep school. You can see, you know, the rabbi or the nun rapping his knuckles. Just claim to obedience. And McNeil, Scalia gets his revenge.
Maybe he's a sub.
Well, possibly. He gets his revenge. And what he says is, look, you had a Sixth Amendment lawyer. That lawyer wasn't appointed to represent you in every case. He was only appointed to represent you in that case. So since they question you about a different case, you needed a Fifth Amendment lawyer. And you didn't have the right to be advised of your Miranda rights. In Montejo, they do away, effectively, with the automatic rule under Michigan versus Jackson that if you had a court-appointed lawyer, he had to be present to the interrogation. And Scalia says the balancing test, the marginal benefits of the Jackson rule didn't pay their way. Balancing, big toilet, pull the chain, fucking pokes go down like little brown turds. That's what happened. Scalia, by the way, goes even one further. He says, not only is this a difference between a Sixth Amendment lawyer appointed in that case and a Fifth Amendment lawyer that would be as to all questioning, but this guy had an appointed lawyer. He didn't request a lawyer. This is Scalia's argument. Even if it is reasonable to presume from a defendant's request for counsel that any subsequent waiver of the right was coerced, no such presumption can seriously be entertained when a lawyer was merely secured on the defendant's behalf by the state itself. Don't you like that? Don't you like that? Can you see it? We did this last year, the judge. Son, I'm going to put you out. Do not appoint me a lawyer. I'm requesting one. Dude, I said I'm going to put everyone in appoint a lawyer. I'm requesting a lawyer. And by the way, if this fucker over here is one of those Sixth Amendment lawyers, I want two lawyers. I want a Sixth Amendment lawyer, and I want me a Fifth Amendment lawyer. I mean, where are we going? Where are we coming with all this? A little more good news, folks, and then we'll shut this down. And that is, the courts are giving greater scrutiny these days to Brady violations. And it starts with an unheralded case from the Supreme Court a year and a half ago, Smith versus Cade. It's an 8-1 opinion written by the Chief Justice. And what they failed to disclose was officers' handwritten notes that were in conflict with the officer's testimony at trial. And the Supreme Court, 8-1, written by the Chief Justice, said that's reversible error if it was material to the decision of guilt or innocence, regardless of the intent or purposefulness of the prosecutor. Let me give you an epilogue of what I told you about last year, my Michael Martin case, Barry Sheck, who many of you know as well. In that case, this was a murder case out of Williamson County, Texas, where the prosecutor concealed from the defense, despite repeated requests, the fact that the 3.5-year-old son had given a recorded statement to his grandmother, who had passed it on to the prosecutor, that daddy not at home, mommy killed by monster with a mustache. Michael Martin was his father. Eden spent 27 years of his life believing that his father had killed his mother. There were three reports from neighbors talking about a green van hanging out behind the house. They suspected there was someone casing the joint. Near where that green van was a bloody bandana. They didn't have DNA 25 years ago. Michael Martin, by the way, was convicted by a Williamson County jury, sentenced to life without parole, and served 25 years in Texas prison. By the way, was offered parole, and he said, that will mean I have to acknowledge that I killed my wife. I won't do it. The bloody bandana, by the way, they didn't even type it for blood. It turns out it had both the victim's blood and that of a male, not Michael Martin. A California database turned up the culprit. He has now been convicted of Michael Martin's wife's killing after his exoneration. And he was also convicted in Austin, Texas, of a related case 3 years later. Had they not focused on Michael Martin, Ms. Buchanan might still be with us. There's some pictures. That's me, the little Jewish lawyer in the back. You recognize Barry. This was Michael upon his release. You notice that the Austin American Statesman was gracious enough to airbrush my bald spot. which I'm forever. On February 6th of this year, Judge Sid Harrell, who was appointed to conduct an inquiry, found that the prosecutor in that case, now sitting District Judge Ken Anderson, had committed 4 felony obstruction offenses. As a result of that, the Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court appointed Judge Stearns of the Court of Criminal Appeals to conduct a court of inquiry, a unique Texas practice. And that began on February 4th. It lasted for a full week of hearings, which we participated in. I was a witness. The Judge Stearns appointed Rusty Hardin of the Roger Clemens and the accounting firm's fame as the special prosecutor. And at the conclusion of that, by the way, the Texas Bar filed a lawsuit to strip Judge Anderson of his law license. Barely 1 month ago, on April 19th, Judge Stearns issued 15-page findings of fact and conclusions of law, first saying that he could not think of a more intentionally harmful act than a prosecutor's conscious choice to hide mitigating evidence so as to create an uneven playing field for a defendant facing a murder charge and a life sentence. And he found, in fact, probable cause to believe that 4 felony acts of obstruction had occurred. He immediately took Judge Anderson into custody in his own courtroom. He was handcuffed behind his back and walked across the street. There's Judge. That's Judge Anderson's, that's his mugshot that same day. And we won't be needing to worry about Judge Anderson's form of justice any longer. Maury Maverick, when I started the practice of law, taught me 45 years ago that the practice of law is a lot like the old hen in the henyard pecking around for corn. You know, every 100 pecks, she finds a kernel. The rest of the time, she's got a beak full of shit. Michael Martin was a kernel of corn, and we practiced day in and day out to find those kernels of corn. The next thing that happened was Hannah Overstreet. A young woman who you may have read about it was sent to jail without life without parole for salt poisoning her child. Junk science. This is me crossing. You notice the Texas Monthly was kind enough to cut off my bald spot. That prosecutor answered 72 successive occasions. I don't recall. I don't remember to a case in which only 2 years before she had put somebody in prison for life without parole. A mother of 5, by the way, with infant children. And she couldn't remember. Fuck that. Anna Jimenez was my chief witness. She was the prosecutor's boss who fired her as a result of what she did. She was elected DA in Nueces County, Corpus Christi, Texas. She left that and joined the Defender Services, where she provides indigent defense in capital cases on behalf of the public defenders in Texas. Anna Jimenez was indicted for 4 counts of perjury in an unrelated case, but a case in which her perjury was a motion she filed in an ongoing death penalty case on behalf of her client, and the indictment was returned in the middle of the death penalty prosecution with no threat of statute of limitations expiring. 70 lawyers joined me day before yesterday. It was just in this tiny little, Edna, Texas is a tiny fucking little burg in Jackson County. And this prosecutor is a mean son of a bitch. I mean, and he was doing his fellow prosecutor's service by indicting Anna on a totally trumped up charge. Just seeing those lawyers, 70 lawyers, 4 past presidents of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, coming up, all of them had cowboy boots, it's Texas. But just hearing that throng coming up those stairs sent chills up my spine. 2 days ago, Anna's indictment was dismissed. Which brings me to why I wanted so much to have y'all last night. And thank you, Christine, for your wonderful hospitality. And I wanted to share with y'all today, and by the way, sitting next to her is one of my heroes and patron saints. Bob Broadus was sheriff here for 27 years, and his enlightened law enforcement is a prelude and a fugue into to number 64. That created an environment in this fair community, this little village, that spread like wildfire across this wonderful state. And there's a reason why we love him. But what I came is I wanted to talk to you about something dear and near to my heart. You know, I'm often reminded of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, in particular the movie. And Gregory Peck has lost his fucking case. And he's packing his stuff up like I'm about to do to leave. And as he's leaving in the bleachers where all the people of color had to sit, a preacher man leans over to Atticus Finch's daughter and says, "Scout, stand up. Your papa's passing." Let me just tell you, that's what we do every day. We stand up. And it's important. It's important we stand up in courtrooms. It's important we stand up in fucking bar rooms. It's important we stand up in classrooms like this. Stand up to injustice whenever and wherever it rears its ugly head. And let me just tell you something. That's what you folks do in courtrooms across this country. So next Monday, when we put on that starched, clean, white shirt or blouse, we stick our chin up and puff our chest out and pull our shoulders back 2 axles wide, and we stand up. We stand up for justice. What you do every day reflects the best tradition of our profession, and you make me proud. Thank you all for allowing me to apologize. So much as I hate to suggest it, let's go party.
This concludes our coverage of normal after legal seminar at 420radio.org. Video recordings of these presentations will be available at 420radio.org.
No way.
And that's a wrap.